Final case for the morning is United States versus Bright, although it's the first case of the afternoon, I guess. Mr. Nolte.
It's GSA time,
really. Excuse me. May it please the court, counsel. I'm here on behalf of Michael Bright, asking this court to reverse the district court's rulings on a motion to suppress physical evidence and motion to suppress statements. We take issue with the district court in two major areas, I guess. The validity of the arrest of the defendant insofar as it affects the subsequent consent to search that was given, and also the court's ruling that the search that was actually conducted was within the scope of whatever voluntary consent might said to have been given. We know that a consent to search that is given during an invalid arrest is presumptively invalid. This court has held that many times. Michael's arrest, we believe, was invalid without probable cause. There was no intervening event of any significance between his arrest and the consent, and that the consent was therefore tainted. He was arrested for the state offense of reckless discharge of a firearm. At the time he was arrested, in our opinion, there is absolutely no justification for essentially jumping to the conclusion that the discharge of this weapon was anything other than accidental. The officers, when they arrived at the apartment complex that Michael resided at, he met them at the door, told them right away that he was the one that had discharged the weapon, and used the phrase, "I screwed up," allowed the officers into his apartment, repeated the explanation of how the weapon discharged, and basically pointed out where he was sitting, how it happened, and where even the bullet traveled. That's what the initial responding officers heard and saw. The shift sergeant, Foltz, who arrived shortly thereafter, was told those same facts, observed the same physical layout, and on that basis decided to arrest Michael for this crime, which requires some element of recklessness. There was nothing that Sergeant Foltz or either of the two other officers that were there that should have led them to believe that this discharge was somehow the product of some gross deviation from the standard of care of a reasonable person, which is the definition of recklessness.
They were confronted, though, with a deviant explanation, right? He separated. He said that it was. He acknowledged he fired it, but he told the neighbor it was a blank, didn't he?
Apparently, quite frankly, the person that called 911, the next door neighbor, didn't testify at the motion to suppress, and so what we heard on that issue was what was related by the 911 operator, and yes, that's what was related. But whether it was a blank or not, I don't see how that has any bearing on what the defendant was doing at the time the gun discharged. I mean, that's really what's important. It's got to be his conduct, not his statements later. That you judge whether or not there's probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed. And during the roughly 10 minutes or so that Sergeant Schultz or Sergeant Foltz was there until the time he ordered the arrest of Michael and the handcuffing, nothing else was learned of any consequence. Nothing else was seen that would bear in any way on Michael's conduct in the discharge of this weapon. And there was testimony from one of the investigating officers that, you know, accidents happen, essentially. I'm paraphrasing, but that's the gist of what Officer Fick admitted that he told the defendant at that time. and so we believe that the finding that there was probable cause to arrest Michael was simply not supported by the evidence. And because of that, the subsequent consent to search is invalid. I mean, he was arrested, whether it be at the time he was handcuffed or at the time he was Mirandized. There's a few minutes in between the handcuffing and the reading of Miranda. Whatever point you pick, whether it be the handcuffing or the Mirandizing, again, nothing occurred or nothing was observed of any consequence between those two. And it was almost immediately after, certainly the Mirandizing, that the consent to search was sought and the forms brought out by Officer Tarantopoulos and read to the defendant and signed while he was handcuffed. They unhandcuffed him so he could sign the form. But there he is sitting in his kitchen, 19 years old, surrounded by three uniformed, armed police officers, handcuffed behind his back. Sure, he's going to sign a consent form, I think, at that point. I mean, he had barely a 10th grade education. The only reason I think that at that point he's going to sign a consent form is because of those circumstances. So we think that on that basis, the search was improper and the evidence seized, other than what was seen by the officers in plain view when they got there. We're not necessarily disputing that. But that which wasn't seen in plain view at that time should be suppressed as the fruit of this tainted consent.
Did the officers, Mr. Nolte, see the black powder canisters when they came in?
No canisters. They observed a black powder pistol on a entertainment center, which was in the living room, some ammunition cartridges on the kitchen table, and I believe some firecrackers or fireworks likewise in the kitchen. The canisters of the Pyrodex and the other powder were found later during the search.
How about these journals?
I beg your pardon?
The journals.
Yes, sir.
Were they actually admitted in evidence?
Yes, sir. Yes, they were. And I guess that brings me to my next part of the argument, is that the consent, the scope of the search, if you find that this consent was voluntary, we take issue with the government's position below and here that it's the consent form that that controls the scope of this search. The government does not even acknowledge the fact that immediately prior to Michael consenting to the search, he was specifically asked by Sergeant Foltz, "Do you mind if we search for other guns? Do you have any other guns? Can we search for other guns?" Not, "Can we search for anything we want? Can we search for anything we decide, or can we search and seize anything we see that piques our interest?" And I think, and I've cited the case law in my brief, that you know, in this kind of a circumstance, the consent, yes, you can search, has to be construed in light of what was actually asked for by the officer, and that is, can we search for guns?
So you think the verbal request, in effect, trumps the form?
Absolutely. And clearly, the three journals in particular, the one found in the trunk of his car and then the two others found in his house.
What did the journals say? What evidence was in the journals that the government used?
Well, there were drawings, almost caricatures, really, of a rocket launcher, some kind of, I'm not sure if it's a pipe bomb or some kind of a pipe bomb. There were little ditties.
I've got the drift, yes, thanks.
And there were, you know, there were entries in these things about cheeseburgers and Cheetos and cheese dip and his work schedule. There are all kinds of doodlings in there that, in my opinion, couldn't possibly have fall within the scope of the consent to search.
Thank you, Mr. Nolfi. Mr. Isaparo?
May it please the court. My name is Michael Isaparo, and I represent the United States of America. First issue that Mr. Nolte addressed, both in his brief and here before this court, was whether there was probable cause to arrest the defendant. I think that there clearly was. The district court was right in concluding that there was, based upon the totality of the evidence before the officers at the apartment that night and the evidence presented to the court. The officers were called there based upon a 911 dispatch that there had been a shot fired at the defendant's apartment complex. They were told over the 911 dispatch that the neighbor had called, that her neighbor had come to her, said that he was acting strangely, and that he had told her that he had fired a blank from his gun. They arrived there, they looked for his apartment, and as they were looking for his apartment, he comes out and tells them, "I screwed up." They asked if they could come in. He invited them in, and he then explained to them that he had accidentally discharged a round from his newly purchased AK-47 as he was disassembling it in his living room. He showed them where the round went, traveled through the living room out towards a residential area behind the apartment complex, through his screen door and out the apartment. They saw ammunition, a couple of firearms, fireworks, and some materials that included pipes and some shotgun shell in a box, all in plain view as they were talking to the defendant and as they were being shown where this bullet traveled. Based upon all of that, there certainly was probable cause that the defendant had acted recklessly, that the offense of reckless discharge to a firearm had occurred. If you take the deviant explanations, if you will, one given to the neighbor that there had been a blank fired from his gun, the fact that he was acting strangely, and then a somewhat different explanation to the police, which is that he actually had fired a real round from his gun as he was disassembling it, that rises to the level of recklessness. He was disassembling a high-powered rifle, an AK-47. Certainly in disassembling it, he could have easily determined whether there was a round in the chamber. It's a high-powered rifle, a dangerous weapon. Anything other than determining whether that gun is completely unloaded before disassembling it is certainly reckless and a deviation from the standard of care that's required.
That certainly is what everyone is told to do with a firearm before they begin to clean it. But we, you know, across the United States, we do have a great number of accidents every year of firearms going off during cleaning, even after people have done that. Is that reckless?
Judge, I think if you take that in combination with the fact that this was a residential area, the small apartment that he was in, that there were apartments on both sides, the fact that he gave two explanations for what happened, I think it does rise to the level of recklessness.
And those two explanations are?
The first given to his neighbor, which was relayed to the police via the 911 dispatcher, which was it was actually a blank that was fired, mm-hmm. And the second given to the police as they arrived there, which was it was a real live bullet that was fired from that gun, and he actually showed them where that bullet traveled, which was out towards some homes behind the apartment
complex. I see. Thank you.
Next issue is the consent, and the only issue with respect to whether the consent was valid or not valid is whether the arrest of the defendant was proper. We argue that it was proper, so then there's no issue as to the validity of the consent, because there's no fruit of the poisonous tree there. If the arrest is proper, then the consent is certainly voluntary and valid. There's no argument here by Mr. Nolte that the consent was anything other than voluntary, just that it was a fruit of an improper arrest. Next along the lines of issues that were raised by the appellant is the scope of the consent. The defendant signed two consent to search forms. They were explained to him. He had the opportunity to read them. The forms were for both the apartment and the vehicle that was parked outside. And they gave the police the right to search, make a complete search of both the apartment and the vehicle. And then further to seize anything that, any property which they determined may pertain to a criminal investigation they were conducting. And that's the language of the forms.
That language about a criminal investigation that they are conducting, wasn't it a fair inference that they were conducting a criminal investigation with respect to firearms?
I think it was a fair inference.
Now I've got my problem. My problem is those doggone notebooks. How do you include those notebooks in the scope of the consent?
Well, Judge, I think that in searching for firearms and firearm-related items, that it's perfectly reasonable to search for indicia of ownership of those firearms, indicia of ownership of those firearm-related items. Examples of those would be receipts from firearm stores, manuals relating to the ownership of those firearms, a FOID card, for example, in Illinois.
I'm sorry, a what?
A firearms owner identification card.
I see.
In Illinois, you're required to have a firearm owner's identification card to legally possess firearms.
And those might be stuck in the notebook, is your theory?
I think that they could, just as the receipts of ownership or
one of those notebooks had a plastic cover with a Velcro latch on it, didn't it?
The first that was found, Judge, in the trunk
of
the vehicle.
It sounds like it's awful private.
Well, Judge, that doesn't mean that the receipts and or FOID card or anything showing the indicia of ownership could not be in that notebook. They could be anywhere where those types of items could be found. They could be in a desk drawer. They could be in a...
What's the limit on the search, then? I mean, suppose there's a library shelf with 50 books. Does that permit examination of each book because he might have used... as a bookmark, his FOIA card?
Judge, in looking for the firearm-related items, if that includes, which we suggest that it does, receipts or indicia of ownership of those items, then the police have a right to search anywhere that those items might be. If that,
find a prayer book on his bedstand.
Well, then, if it includes a book on the bookshelf, or
I said a prayer book on his bedstand.
Judge, I think that that's some place where those items might be as well. If they're hidden in a book in the trunk of the vehicle or a book on the bookshelf, they could just as easily be hidden in a prayer book at the defendant's bedside.
The evidence extracted from them was the evidence of what?
From the notebooks?
Drawings and things like that in it?
Drawings of pipe bombs, diagrams of pipe bombs. There was a list of individuals, senators, celebrities. Next to those names was the word marked. Later on in the investigation and interviewing this defendant, they asked him what that word marked meant, and he said that that meant those persons were marked to die or marked to kill.
So this was relevant and probative with respect to intent?
With respect to intent as to count two. And it was also relevant and probative with respect to count one because of the statutory defense which was raised with respect to count one, and that was the defense was that the defendant possessed the explosive materials solely for lawful cultural, sporting, or recreational purposes. Once that defense was raised, we were required to negate that defense.
What other? I'm throwing you a line here. I mean, I want to see if you got a harmless error kind of a. What other evidence do you have of intent?
The defendant's own statements that he in fact possessed the materials to make pipe bombs, that he had all the materials to make pipe bombs, that he intended to use those materials, in his words, if something happened, and the example was another revolution. There was the statement was a written statement in which he said that the materials were there to make all the pipe bombs. He had all the necessary materials, and that it was his intent to do so.
Did he have to have an intent to kill a particular individual, or to kill any, or to kill? Period.
The way that the count two and the statute reads is that the intent applies to killing any individual, injuring any individual, or causing real or personal property damage, and that's the way it was charged.
Any individual?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. That's helpful. Appreciate it.
In short, there was probable cause to arrest. Because there was probable cause to arrest, there was no problem with the voluntary consent that was given. Police officers properly searched within the scope of the consent that was given, and all the evidence that was admitted properly as to count one to negate the statutory defense and as to count two to prove the intent with respect to that charge. We ask this court to affirm the defendant's conviction. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Penalty, your time had expired, but you may have 2 minutes.
Initial comment, I guess, in rebuttal would be with regard to the government's statement that it was reasonable to look in these notebooks for receipts for guns. I guess those are the receipts we're referring to, or a FOID card or things of that nature. Two things about that. Number one, the officers already knew that Michael Bright had a valid FOID card. I don't know if it was Officer Sarantopoulos or Vic who testified that was within their knowledge before the consent to search was even discussed. and with regard to receipts, I go back to what was asked of Michael in terms of consent. Guns and ammunition. Can we search for guns and ammunition? And would a typical reasonable person take that to mean, take the words guns and ammunition to mean receipts and all this other paperwork that the government says it was proper to look for? I don't think a typical reasonable person would come to that conclusion, and I don't think that the district court was correct in finding that was an appropriate within the scope of the consent. With regard to my second argument, I'll stand on my written brief.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Mosley. Thanks to all counsel. Case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.